police officers are rushing up the hill at this time.
The most shocking thing about the assassination is not the brutality of it. It was brutal, certainly. But the most amazing thing is the way the established media today managed to pretend that there is any question about whether his murder was a conspiracy. We need to understand the images we've been looking at. This is Dealey Plaza, the scene of the crime. This is the school book depository building and the sixth floor window from which Oswald supposedly did his shooting. Abraham Zapruder was standing here with his home movie camera when he took the graphic pictures you just saw of the assassination, the Zapruder film. And this is the so-called grassy knoll. We'll talk more about that in a minute. The official government version of the murder, the Warren Commission report, found that Lee Harvey Oswald fired 3 shots from the 6th floor of the Dallas School Book Depository building. They tell us that the first shot missed, that the 2nd shot hit both Kennedy and the governor of Texas, and the 3rd shot, from behind, hit Kennedy in the head and killed him. But it's hard to watch the Zapruder film of Kennedy being thrown violently backward and to the left and not think that he was shot from the front. This is Dr. Cyril Wecht. As the former head of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, he is the expert elected by the experts to represent them.
If you have that kind of force slamming into the rear of somebody's head, then that should drive the individual forward. But instead, we have him moving backward and to the left. That suggests the very distinct possibility of another shot having been fired in synchronized fashion from the right side, the so-called grassy knoll area.
But he's not the only one who thinks there was a shot fired from the grassy knoll. These people are standing in front of the grassy knoll, and they are ducking because they heard a shot fired over their heads. The people you see running are running towards the grassy knoll, heroically trying to catch the assassins. If Kennedy had actually been shot from behind, as the government says, he ought to have a small entrance wound on the back of his head. And this is the Navy doctor that the government got to write this report saying that Kennedy did have this small wound in the back of his head. But there are some things you should know about this guy. In a standard examination, he should have examined Kennedy's clothing for bullet holes. He didn't. In a standard autopsy, he should have dissected all of Kennedy's wounds to trace the bullet's path. He didn't dissect any of Kennedy's wounds. He didn't even realize Kennedy had a throat wound. He later claimed these drawings of his were wrong, and that the wounds were actually much higher. He lost Kennedy's brain, which is still missing, and then he burned his notes. He burned his notes. But perhaps we shouldn't be too hard on him, because this guy, Dr. James Humes, had never done an autopsy involving gunshot wounds before in his life. So naturally, he was the government's first choice to do the most important autopsy in American history. Dr. Humes' story about a small exit wound in the back of Kennedy's head is today the official government version. But this is not the story the New York Times told on the day Kennedy died. On the left in this picture, we see the New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Tom Weikert in Dallas outside Parkland Memorial Hospital. He spoke to the doctors who had been called to the emergency room to treat the president, and his story later appeared the same day on the front page. His article states, "Later in the afternoon, Dr. Malcolm Perry and attending physician Dr. Kemp Clark, chief of neurosurgery at Parkland Hospital, gave more details. Mr. Kennedy was hit by a bullet in the throat, just below the Adam's apple, they said. This wound had the appearance of a bullet's entry. Entry wounds on the front. Mr. Kennedy also had a massive gaping wound in the back, and one on the right side of his head. The wound on the right was the entry for the shot from the grassy knoll. The wound in the back was the exit for that bullet that sent Kennedy's brains flying. Today, the doctors are still unanimous in describing a large exit wound in the back of Kennedy's head.
I was probably looking into a wound that was on the lateral or the side part of the head and the back part of the head.
It would be this portion of the head right here.
That wound was
As I remember, it's like this,
that there was a big wound, big deficit in his skull and the temporal parietal area.
If you listen carefully, you will even hear Walter Cronkite admit that the autopsy photos show this large hole in the back of Kennedy's head.
The drawing was approved by Dr. McClellan, one of the attending physicians in Dallas. The drawing suggests what many of the photos examined by the doctors in Nova show, a large wound about this size and location.
Now, if you're like me, you need to hear that 8 or 9 more times.
The drawing suggests what many of the photos examined by the doctors in Nova show, a large wound about this size and location.
There is really no room for debate on this point. Kennedy had a huge exit wound in the back of his head because the shot that killed him came from the front and could not have been fired by Oswald, who was behind the president. This information did not start off as a secret. It was made into a secret by constant authoritative denial of the truth. The lying continues today.
Good evening, I'm Peter Jennings. 40 years after the assassination, the latest ABC News poll tells us that more than two-thirds of Americans still believe there was a conspiracy to kill the president.
And Jennings thinks that he's the man to fix this problem, that two-thirds of the American people believe the conspiracy theories that say that the government is lying.
What we will do tonight is demonstrate that those theories are wrong.
Of course, he will have to lie to do that. This is Malcolm Kilduff, Kennedy's assistant press secretary. He is speaking at a press conference at the Dallas Hospital where the president has just been pronounced dead. Please notice the ABC logo. This is from Jennings' video.
He died of a gunshot wound in the brain.
And they fade the scene out. No more press conference. But now watch this. The same guy, the same press conference, no ABC logo.
Kennedy died at approximately 1 o'clock Central Standard Time today here in Dallas. He died of a gunshot wound in the brain. Dr. Berkeley told me it's a simple matter, Tom, of a bullet right through the head.
The president's press secretary tried to show us how the head wound was inflicted, but Jennings cut that out because it destroys the lie that he's trying to tell. Jennings also attacks the movie JFK for misleading people to make them think that there was a shot from the front.
Key shot. The president going back and to his left. Shot from the front and right. Totally inconsistent with a shot from the depository. Again. Back and to the left. Back and to the left. Back and to the left. Back and to the left.
So how does Jennings refute this powerful evidence? He doesn't even try, really. He simply lies.
Back and to the left in no way indicates where a bullet came from.
One of the leading forensic scientists in America says that the film shows
the very distinct possibility of another shot having been fired in synchronized fashion from the right side, the so-called grassy knoll area.
But we're just supposed to take Jennings' word for it. This sort of take my word for it is standard operating procedure for Jennings.
In all these years, there has not been a single piece of credible evidence to prove a conspiracy.
In fact, 100% of the medical personnel in Dallas who saw the president's wounds described a large exit wound in the back of Kennedy's head about this size and location. Virtually all the witnesses near the grassy knoll say they heard a shot from that direction, and dozens of them chased after the gunman who fired that shot. Congress hired acoustic experts to analyze the sounds of a tape recording of the assassination. Their report was decisive and powerful.
With a probability of 95% or better, there was indeed a shot fired from the grassy knoll.
And Jennings' response to this mountain of proof is,
in all these years, there has not been a single piece of credible evidence to prove a conspiracy.
Now, there's a problem here. Jennings is a newsman. If people come to see him as a crude liar, his career is finished. Why would he risk everything telling such weak and obvious lies about a murder that took place 40 years ago? The men who killed the President of the United States and got away with it were obviously very powerful then, and apparently they are still very powerful people.
Your name is Big Brother. You've killed all our leaders. I don't even have to do nothing to you. You've caused your own country to fall.
Can we help to give John Kennedy a voice? To write his history as he would have written it? I think we owe it to him to try. The heroes who made the movie JFK have tried. In the movie, Jim Garrison, the New Orleans district attorney, calls the official government version of the shooting
one of the grossest lies ever forced on the American people. We've come to know it as the magic bullet theory. The magic bullet enters the president's back, headed downward at an angle of 17 degrees. It then moves upward in order to leave Kennedy's body from the front of his neck, wound number two.
He forgot to mention that in order for the bullet to get from Kennedy's back to the front of his throat, it would have to penetrate and exit his spine, one of the strongest bones in the body. The people who tell you there was no conspiracy are also telling you to believe that this bullet left Kennedy's body from the front of his neck,
where it waits 1.6 seconds, presumably in midair, where it turns right, then left, and continues into Connally's body at the rear of his right armpit, wound number three. The bullet then heads downward at an angle of 27 degrees, shattering Connally's fifth rib and exiting from the right side of his chest, wound number four. The bullet then turns right and re-enters Connally's body at his right wrist, wound number five. Shattering the radius bone, the bullet then exits Connally's wrist, wound number six, makes a dramatic U-turn, and buries itself into Connally's left thigh, wound number seven, from which it later falls out and is found in almost pristine condition on a stretcher in a corridor of Parkland Hospital.
Again, he has left out some crucial details. Large bullet fragments were removed from Connally's leg and wrist. These are the fragments from his wrist. But the bullet that was found on the hospital stretcher was completely undamaged and was not missing any fragments. And it was found on the wrong stretcher, one that was next to John Connally's stretcher.
The bullet was found here in this area, and not on that stretcher. That's the stretcher I took off the elevator. It was there when I came up.
That's some bullet.
But we're not done with this bullet yet. You remember this guy?
At the National Archives in Washington, Dr. Cyril Wecht, former head of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, examined bullets the Warren Commission had test-fired. To find out if a bullet could break so many bones and remain apparently intact, the commission used a rifle similar to Oswald's.
And then they got these bullets, all 6.5 millimeter. And they test fired, first into cotton wadding. These two bullets were fired into cotton wadding, striking nothing. You will note that these bullets both have a minimal degree of protrusion of the lead at the base. Otherwise, they are intact, which is what you would expect. The next bullet broke one rib of a goat carcass. Notice, please, it's widening. This bullet struck one of the two large bones that come down from the elbow to the wrist in a human cadaver. They wanted to simulate the fracture of that same bone in Governor Connally. Please note the substantial deformity. This is classical, typical, when a bullet strikes a dense, heavy bone or some other very firm object. Now, I want you to look at the so-called stretcher bullet. This bullet is the actual bullet that the Warren Commission claims broke both John Connally's right fifth rib, destroying 4 inches of that bone, pulverizing it, and which caused a comminuted or extensively fragmented fracture of a dense, heavy bone down near the base of the wrist and emerged in this condition. You will see that it is near pristine. As a matter of fact, its nose, the cone, the sides of the bullet are completely intact and unscathed. It has only minimal protrusion of the lead core at the base, in the same fashion that the two bullets did that had been fired in the test wadding. That's from the impact of the firing mechanism.
He neglected to mention that this bullet had no blood on it.
This single bullet explanation is the foundation of the Warren Commission's claim of a lone assassin. And once you conclude the magic bullet could not create all seven of those wounds, you have to conclude that there was a fourth shot and a second rifleman. And if there was a second rifleman, then by definition, there had to be a conspiracy.
We have to come up with a new word, it seems. Anti-conspiracy nut.
Y'all got to start thinking on a different level, like the CIA does. Now, we're through the looking glass here, people. White is black, and black is white.
What is that supposed to mean? It means that all of our assumptions are wrong, that everything is the opposite of what we have been told to believe, the opposite of what we expect to be true. Let's try this. Let's try thinking differently. We were told that one bullet made all of these wounds. What's the opposite of that? The opposite would be that every wound was made by a different bullet. Let's count them. Kennedy's back, 1. Kennedy's throat, 2. Kennedy's head, 3. Connolly's ribs, 4. Connolly's wrist, 5. Connolly's leg, 6. Since we're counting bullets, remember that even the government admits that the first shot missed. So let's add one more. The first shot missed, 7. Photographs show, and 4 witnesses have said, that there was a bullet hole in the windshield. The witnesses include a doctor.
But it was very clear. It was a through and through bullet hole through the windshield of the car from the front to the back.
A Secret Service agent's report and the supervisor of the men who repaired the windshield.
It was a good, clean bullet hole right straight through the front.
Photographs also show a bullet hole in the convertible roof frame over the windshield.
The third wounded man, James Tague, who was nicked by a fragment while standing near the triple underpass.
And several witnesses, including 2 police officers, reported seeing bullets impact the street, the curb, the sidewalk, and the grass. We are told that Oswald acted alone. And what's the opposite of that? The makers of JFK estimate that this hail of bullets was fired by 3 teams of shooters, a small army, including spotters as many as 13 people. We are told that Kennedy was the most powerful man in the world, brought down by a powerless, minimum-wage nobody. And what's the opposite of that? And what does it look like when real power kills a president who thinks wrongly that he has the power?
Ordinarily, a unit of military, I think was called a Special Group Number 113, would have come up from San Antonio, Texas, and would have been deployed all through the streets of Dallas, the important streets of Dallas. That was not done. In fact, the commander was specifically told he wasn't needed.
Secret Service regulations require that any time the president's car slows down below 44 miles per hour, the security must be poured on.
You've all seen the picture of the school book building, you know, where Oswald is supposed to have shot the president. You notice in those pictures there are open windows. If the Secret Service had been there and had done their usual job, none of those windows would have been open. And had anyone opened one of those windows at that time, they would have been on the radio, they would have had a man in that room immediately, and the window would have been closed. You see, that's protection.
Instead, as the president's car slowed to execute a hairpin turn into the killing zone, not only had the support from the Army been canceled, but
no Secret Service agent was in that area.
What are we looking at here? Handles on the back of the president's limo? Why? Duh. Normally, in a motorcade, Secret Service agents would be riding on the back of his car and run along beside him whenever the car slowed down. In Dallas, these agents were ordered to abandon their positions. They didn't agree with it. They didn't like it. But they followed their orders. Normally, there would be four motorcycles on each side of the president's limousine. This is what the Dallas police prepared for. However, all of the motorcycle police were removed from escorting the president. Two were placed on each side of the car containing the Secret Service agents, and the rest were moved to the back of the parade.
If I was president, I'd get elected on Friday, assassinated on Saturday, buried on
Sunday. Look at the people in these crowds. They are 10 and 12 deep in some places. Just before the last turn in the motorcade, we can see people are still standing 5 feet deep to see the president. But then the limousine turns the corner, drives 100 yards, and what happened? Where are all the people? The killers were nearly able to completely eliminate the witnesses to their crime by excluding them from Dealey Plaza. They controlled the murder scene. They made sure that
no Secret Service agent was in that area.
Except for the small army of their people running around with Secret Service credentials.
When I got here, I was stopped by a person in a suit with an overcoat over his arm, thrown over his arm. Also had a gun under his arm. It looked like a little machine gun to me, a small machine gun.
Tell them the truth, the truth. Tell them about JFK.
Normally, Kennedy would be accompanied on such a motorcade by his personal physician and his military aide, the person responsible for carrying the portable phone that allowed the president to be in constant communication with the National Security Agency, in case of a sneak attack by the Russians, for example. In an extraordinary move, these two men were excluded from Kennedy's limousine. However, they did provide Kennedy with a driver who, film shows, was braking until after the fatal headshot to the president. In this frame, close to 12 shots have been fired. The president and Governor Connally already have 5 wounds between them. There's a hole in the freaking windshield, and this sucker has his foot on the brake. But watch this. Look at the driver. What is he doing? His training says that he should be speeding away from the scene. His partner is supposed to have jumped into the back seat, thrown the president to the floor, and jumped on top of him to shield him. But instead, they are both completely turned around, watching the president die. Why? What possible explanation is there for this extraordinary behavior? It is not until the driver sees the president receive the fatal shot to the head that he finally turns around and drives off at top speed. Now, you can invent an explanation for this behavior if you choose to, but then you have to invent an explanation for why this man was never questioned by the investigators regarding his most unusual behavior. The most obvious explanation is that this man was part of a conspiracy, that his job was to keep the president in the line of fire until he was dead. Certainly, that's the job that he performed. In the first minutes after the assassination, the true story went out about the fatal shot from the front. But as the hours went by, invisible forces began to black out the truth, take control of the story, and the language that could be used to discuss the assassination. Their words, their version of events, went out steadily and unstoppably and penetrated deeply into the killer's well-oiled propaganda machine. At 5:10, the afternoon of the murder, the code word SLUMP, the official lie, first appears, this time on the death certificate. Minutes later, while Governor Connally is lying in his hospital bed, he repeats the code word that the killers have decided to use to describe the president as he was shot.
I turned to look in the back seat. The president had slumped. He had said nothing.
Slumped? The dictionary defines slump as to drop, collapse, or fall down. Connally saw the president choking on a bullet in his throat, but he didn't see him slump until after he saw him thrown violently backwards as his brains were blown out. This exact same peculiarly inaccurate choice of words shows up everywhere, not only on the death certificate, but in newspapers and magazines, and 40 years later you can find it in the most popular high school history book in the country. But let's wait 1 minute here to take a second careful look at the man who was chosen by the killers to ride in the car directly in front of the president.
He had said nothing.
Apparently, on the day of the murder, the killers were primarily concerned with overriding the accounts of the numerous witnesses who said that the president's brains were blown out the back of the limousine by a shot from the front. So, the official story on the day of the murder was that there were three shots, that the first one hit Kennedy in the back, the second hit Connolly, and the third hit the president in the head, and he slumped. And this is the version of events that the governor is supporting here.
We had just turned the corner. We heard a shot. I turned to look in the back seat. The president had slumped. He had said nothing. Almost simultaneously, as I turned, I was hit. And I knew I'd been hit badly.
But later, the Warren Commission looked at the Zapruder film and saw clearly that the first shot had missed, and they came up with the ridiculous single bullet theory. But if Connolly and Kennedy were hit by the same bullet, Connolly could not have looked in the back seat and seen that the president had been hit, so it was necessary for Connolly to change his story, and he did.
Unquestionably, when the first shot was fired, I recognized it as a shot. I thought of nothing else but that it was a rifle shot. I turned to my right. I had time to think. I had time to react. And I turned to my right to look back over my right shoulder to see if I could see anything unusual, and particularly to see if I could catch the president out of the corner of my eye, because I immediately thought of an assassination attempt the moment I heard the shot. I didn't see anything except just the general blur of waving, of people moving, but nothing really unusual. I did not see the president out of the corner of my eye, and I was in the process of turning back to look over my...
They needed Connolly to see the president slump, then that's what he said he saw. When they later needed him not to have seen the president before he was hit, then he didn't see him. It certainly appears that Connolly is a tool of the killers, doesn't it? We'll come back to him when it's time to start naming names. But until then, don't forget John Connolly. If Kennedy was surrounded by enemies at the last moments of his life, at the moment of his death, they literally swarmed over his body.
Tell the children the truth, the truth. Christopher Columbus didn't discover America. Tell them the truth, yay.
If you live in Los Angeles and you fly to Chicago and your wife is found murdered, they will go to Chicago and get you and bring you back and have a trial in the city where the murder took place. President Kennedy was murdered in Dallas. The murder investigation, including the autopsy, should, by law, have taken place in Dallas. Instead, the body was stolen by the Secret Service and loaded onto Air Force One for a flight to Washington. What happened next is difficult to believe. The evidence is overwhelming, but it may take some courage on your part to believe your eyes and ears.
What is very clear is that the president's body did not make an uninterrupted journey from Dallas to Bethesda. It began in a large ceremonial casket. It was placed in that casket by Orby Reich of the O'Neill Funeral Home.
I helped put President Kennedy's body in a bronze ceremonial casket on November 22nd, 1963 at Parkland Memorial Hospital.
He wrapped the body in sheets. It was placed in the casket.
The bronze casket was placed on board Air Force One. This was not the casket from which Kennedy's body was removed by Bethesda autopsy technician Paul O'Connor.
We opened the pinkish gray shipping casket. There was a gray body bag, zipped shut. We unzipped the body bag, and the president's body was lifted out of the body bag.
Reich told Lifton that Kennedy's body was not in a body bag when it left Dallas. How could he be so certain?
I remember picking him up, huh? I was one that had the blood on my shirt and everything from the body. If he'd been in a crash bag, he couldn't have got any blood on him because it's a sealed bag.
David Lifton has uncovered this uncontested best eyewitness testimony indicating that the president's body was stolen from a bronze ceremonial casket and switched to a plain pinkish-gray shipping casket. While the president's widow and brother were keeping a sad watch over an empty casket, agents of the most powerful criminals on earth crudely performed the grisly task of changing the wounds on the front of the president's body. This is the first piece of evidence that attracted David Lifton's attention to the question of how the president's body was handled. The report, written by two FBI agents present at the autopsy, says that
it was apparent that surgery of the head area was done before the autopsy started.
Lifton also noticed that the doctors who received the body for the autopsy in Washington reported seeing wounds that looked very different from the wounds described by the doctors in the Dallas emergency room.
We have two groups of doctors seeing the body, which is evidence. Their observations are 6 hours apart.
And yet,
the autopsy descriptions of the wounds were substantially different from the way the doctors in Dallas described them, as David Lifton explains.
The reason for altering the body is that the body is the diagram of the shooting, and it's the most important evidence in the case. Someone wants to make it appear in the evidence that President Kennedy was struck twice from behind from the direction of the school book depository building, and to obliterate any evidence of frontal entry. That's my opinion about what these facts mean.
These are incredibly serious charges, with absolutely enormous implications. But are these charges true? The FBI memo is powerful evidence, but can we verify what it says? Can we see the surgery referred to in this memo? Clearly, the FBI agents were not referring to the left side of Kennedy's head. If there is any surgery here, it is not apparent. When we look at this autopsy photo of the right side of Kennedy's head, we see a large cut in this area. This certainly is what we might call apparent surgery. It does not look like a bullet wound at all. It looks as if some Boy Scout got out his pocket knife and crudely cut a V in the president's scalp and then ripped the skin back. But why? Looking at a black and white version, it is possible to see a probable bullet hole here. This picture was taken before the autopsy. Unless Lifton is right and the body was secretly stolen and then carved up, this photo ought to show the president's head in exactly the same condition as it was when it left Dallas. Does it? This is an absolutely critical question. 25 years after the assassination, the people at NOVA got the bright idea to fly the Dallas physicians who examined Kennedy into Washington to the National Archives to take a look at photos taken immediately after Kennedy's body arrived in Washington, before the autopsy began. They were given as much time as they wanted.
I would have to say, honestly, in looking at these photos, they're pretty much as I remember President Kennedy at the time, except...
He is saying that the wounds are not the same as he remembers them.
Except for that little incision that seems to be coming down in the parietal area. On looking at the photographs, I could envision that an incision might have been made in order to pull the scalp back to expose this bone.
That would seem to settle the question. We have the FBI memo, expert eyewitness testimony, and the photo itself taken before the autopsy started, all showing this crude cutting and ripping which mysteriously appeared after the body left the Dallas hospital. But how? How was this cutting and ripping done? And when and where? And who done it?
But an Air Force officer claims the body could not have been switched because the casket was in his view for all but 5 minutes of the journey from Dallas to Bethesda.
Well, there you go. While everyone on Air Force One was gathered in the front of the plane for 5 minutes, watching President Johnson being sworn in, for example, the agents of evil snatched the body out of the casket and snuck it off the plane. But you know, it doesn't really matter when, where, and how. It was done. What matters is who. Who could have done it?
Come on. Could the mob change the parade route, Bill? Or eliminate the protection for the president? Could the mob send Oswald to Russia and get him back? Could the mob get the FBI, the CIA, and the Dallas police to make a mess of the investigation? I mean, could the mob get the Warren Commission appointed to cover it up? Could the mob wreck the autopsy? I mean, could the mob influence the national media to go to sleep?
These are fair questions. In the hours after Kennedy's murder, we would imagine that the FBI and Secret Service agents would be under a super heightened state of security, trying to make up for letting the president die by now protecting his body. Who could have penetrated this security in order to steal and mutilate the body of the slain president? Certainly not the mafia, not the Cubans, not even the Russians. No way. What we have here is proof positive that the investigation of Kennedy's murder was sabotaged by members of his own government at the very highest levels. So what? They covered it up. Cover-up is not the same as murder, is it? Is it? Well, it depends. If you shoot the president at 12 noon exactly, and then you come running up to me and say,
I just shot the president, hide me.
Say I was with you. And suppose I do. Suppose I take you in and loan you a change of clothes and say you were with me. What am I really guilty of? Not murder. I helped you try to escape, but I didn't help you kill anyone, and I didn't even know about it until after it happened. I am what is called an accessory after the fact. I might get off with 5 years, maybe less. But suppose instead that while you're shooting the president, I'm sitting at the curb in a getaway car with the motor running. You jump in, and without saying a word, I step on the gas and take off, heading for the airport with 2 tickets to Mexico in my pocket, one for me and one for you. Why did I buy the tickets? Why was I waiting at the curb with the motor running, and why did I take off in such a hurry? I was in on it. I had to be. I am an accessory before the fact, and whatever they do to you, they're going to do to me. Because being an accessory before the fact makes you guilty of conspiracy to murder. Now, Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested because he matched a description of the president's killer put out over the police radio. But nobody claims to have seen the president's killers, and so nobody knows where this description of Oswald came from. But never mind, a description of Oswald mysteriously goes out on the police radio, and 20 cops descend on Oswald and arrest him for going into a movie theater without buying a 75-cent ticket. But the police didn't have any evidence against him. None.
I didn't shoot anybody, no, sir.
When they finally charged Oswald with the president's murder, it was nearly midnight, and they still had no evidence against him. The question is, how did they know at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when they stole the body for the first time? How did they know at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when they stole the body for the second time? The autopsy began around 6 p.m. Dallas time. How did they know 5 hours before Oswald was even charged that they needed to cut up the evidence that Kennedy was shot from the front? How did they know just hours after the assassination that it was impossible to have a real investigation and to catch the real killers? How did they know? How could they have known? The men who stole Kennedy's body and mutilated it were accessories before the fact. They were guilty of conspiracy to murder. They were in on the assassination, part of the operation from the beginning. They were powerful men to be able to do what they did and get away with it. Who had such power?
Waking for the CIA, they wouldn't have you in the mafia.
Why can't we be fair? Why can't we be fair? Why can't we be fair?
We now have some background to take up the momentous question of who shot President Kennedy. This question is easier to answer than you might think. Spotlight magazine published an article citing a memo written by this man, former CIA Director Richard Helms, which places this man, an admitted CIA assassin, in Dallas on the day that Kennedy was murdered. The memo says, Hunt was in Dallas the day the president was murdered and was involved in the conspiracy to kill Kennedy. Hunt sued Spotlight magazine for slander and had his day in court. Hunt's explanation of where he was on the day that Kennedy was murdered was a disaster of impossible lies. Over the years, Hunt has given 5 different explanations of where he was on the day that Kennedy was murdered, and the jury found him guilty of the president's murder when they found the magazine innocent of slander. There is at least one story from this trial that should be told. During the trial, former head of CIA Richard Helms testified that Marita Lorenz was a CIA agent known to him and working for them. Her role in a CIA plot to assassinate Castro was the plot of a movie. During the court proceedings, Ms. Lorenz testified that she was part of the CIA's Operation 40, which carried out terrorist raids against Cuba from 1960 to 1963. During November of 1963, she was working with this man, CIA operative Frank Sturgis. She testified that one day Sturgis came and told her to pack her bags, that they were going on a mission. A short time later, she drove to Dallas with Sturgis in 2 station wagons full of men and guns. There was a knock at the door, and E. Howard Hunt came in and began passing out maps and money. This was clearly shaping up as an attack not upon Cuba, but upon Americans on American soil. Lorenz told Sturgis, "I'm getting the hell out of here," and took a cab to the airport and flew back to Miami. The next day, President Kennedy was murdered. Sturgis returned later, saying, "You should have been there. We made history. You missed the really big one. We killed the president." Again, after listening to all the testimony in the trial, the jury found that Spotlight magazine did not slander Hunt when Spotlight printed an article saying that Hunt had murdered John Kennedy. But Hunt did not have the ability to steal the body from the Dallas coroner, or to steal it again from the Secret Service, and remove it from its coffin, and mutilate it, and then return it without attracting public attention, and he didn't have the ability to get all of the media to lie about it for the next 40 years. That those theories are wrong. The theft of the body, for example, could only have been carried out by the most powerful devils in the world. Devils so powerful we would recognize their names if we heard them. Can we connect Hunt to any major league devils? Former President Richard Nixon might be a good place to start. Even though he's not generally regarded as an expert in handling guns, he is generally regarded as one of the most evil people to ever occupy the White House. And it's not a secret. Everybody knows.
You, the jury of the damned. Benedict Arnold, Lizzie Borden, Richard Nixon.
But I'm not dead yet. In fact, I just wrote an article for Redbook.
Hey, listen, I did a favor for you.
Yes, Master.
Richard Nixon chose E. Howard Hunt to lead his private White House goon squad, the so-called Plumbers Unit. Hunt became famous as the head of the Watergate burglars, but after his arrest for breaking into the Watergate Hotel, while he was sitting in jail, Hunt suddenly began sending messages to Nixon that he needed $1 million to keep his mouth shut. At the same time, Hunt started talking to reporters, saying that he was a CIA assassin. To the thousands of people who believed that the CIA had killed Kennedy, this was earth-shaking news. Hunt was threatening to tell about the Kennedy assassination if Nixon didn't get him the hell out of jail and get him $1 million. He called up the FBI and told them they had to stop investigating Hunt's activities in Mexico. He said the FBI investigation would threaten to uncover the whole Bay of Pigs thing. The whole Bay of Pigs thing? What is that supposed to mean? Bob Haldeman was Nixon's chief of staff and closest advisor. Haldeman says, "It seems that in all those references to the Bay of Pigs, he was actually referring to the Kennedy assassination." Nixon was forced to resign based upon the single charge that he tried to stop the FBI from investigating Hunt. But why should Nixon care what Hunt said or what the FBI found out about the Kennedy assassination? Unless he was involved. Was Nixon involved in the Kennedy assassination? One of the most stunning revelations about Nixon to be uncovered recently is this little gem. It seems that Jack Ruby, the mafia thug who shot Oswald, who was spotted by a Dallas reporter in the Parkland Hospital in the area where the magic bullet was found on the wrong stretcher, was working for Congressman Richard Nixon in 1947. Nixon admits that he was in Dallas the day that Kennedy was murdered. So what? So what is that?
It's almost become a cliche to say it, but, you know, everybody remembers where they were when the assassination took place. The country changed, their lives changed, and nothing would ever be the same.
Well, almost everybody remembers. It seems that Nixon, like Hunt, can't remember what he was doing on the day that Kennedy was murdered. You see, in 1964, he told Reader's Digest,
"I boarded a plane from Dallas to New York. I hailed a cab. We were waiting for the light to change when a man ran over from the street corner and said that the president had just been shot in Dallas. This is the way I heard the news."
However, exactly 9 years later, he told Esquire magazine,
On arrival in New York, we caught a cab and headed for the city. A woman came out of her house screaming and crying. She told us that John Kennedy had just been shot in Dallas.
Why does Nixon remember two different versions of how he found out that Kennedy was dead? Perhaps, like Hunt, he can't tell the truth about where he was and what he was doing. But Nixon wasn't a powerful devil in 1963. In fact, he had quit politics completely after losing the election in 1960 to Kennedy and then losing the election for governor in California in 62. But it is clear that he had a close relationship with another suspect in this case.
As president, he shocked political observers by bringing in a Democrat to be his Secretary of the Treasury, the Texas Democrat who was sitting in front of Kennedy when his brains were blown out.
Who held Kennedy's hand and pretended that nothing was going on as he led him into the killing zone. John Connally, the Democratic governor of Texas. It's important to remember that these guys are really just small-time devils, and we need a little bit of historical background on the really big devils before going on. America is home to some of the most brutally vicious, racist monsters in all of history. American slave owners invented state-sponsored racism. And the wars of extermination against the first Americans killed a higher percentage of their race than Hitler's attempt to exterminate the Jews. It should come as no surprise, then, that the most powerful families in this country, the Fords, the Harrimans, and especially the Rockefellers, supported racism and genocide and Hitler from the very beginning.
This is J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI for nearly 40 years. He has recently been criticized for being gay and a cross-dresser. He has been criticized for a long time for being a racist, but you have to admire his skills as an investigator. Hoover investigated the Nazi connections of all these people and brought actions against them. For example, Hoover investigated the Nazi connections of Union Bank of New York, and in 1942, the year the U.S. entered the war, the bank was seized as a Nazi asset. Prescott Bush, the president's grandfather, was a director and chief executive officer of that bank. And when the U.S. government grabbed the bank, he protested. He said, "Wait a minute, that's my bank." Hoover said, "That's right. No mistake. You're a Nazi. You run a Nazi bank." So Hoover knew that Prescott Bush was a Nazi. This is going to be extremely important later, so please make a note to yourself. Hoover knew that the Bushes were Nazis. But let's get back to this guy, Prescott Bush, the president's grandfather. He was a co-director of this Nazi bank with this Nazi, Averill Harriman, his boss. Prescott Bush was also a full partner in Brown Brothers Harriman. They were the closest of business associates. Remember the trial of E. Howard Hunt, where the jury found Hunt guilty of the murder of President Kennedy? During this trial, Hunt testified that immediately after World War II, he was in Paris working directly for Averill Harriman, reporting directly on a daily basis to his boss. So the Bushes run around in a tight circle that includes other Nazis and Kennedy killers, a truly evil circle of friends. Of course, this doesn't prove that the Bushes killed JFK, but it ought to provoke some investigation on our part. So let's do some investigating. We just saw that in 1942, Hoover forced Prescott Bush to give up his active political support for his favorite young politician, Adolf Hitler. However, 4 short years later, he found another young man to sponsor in politics, Nixon, who is documented as employing Jack Ruby a year after this photo was taken. Nixon, who hired Hunt, who hired Connally, was created and sponsored from the very beginning by Prescott Bush. Are you surprised? Well, you better get over it in a hurry.
This barely readable piece of paper was declassified by the FBI in 1977 and released. It's a memo written by J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI. The title is Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It is about a meeting that took place between the FBI and the CIA the day after the assassination.
The memo names George Bush as one of two CIA officials sent to get Hoover's report on the activities of the CIA's misguided anti-Castro Cubans. The memo was a scandal when it was made public in 1988 because it says that George Bush was in the CIA in 1963 It says that Bush lied when he told the public that he had no CIA experience before becoming director in 1974. It means he was in the CIA when he ran for Senate and lost in 1964, and when he ran for Senate and lost in 1970. And it means that he was in the CIA when Nixon brought him into the White House, trailing E. Howard Hunt behind him. In 1992, Bush was first confronted with this memo, and he had a chance to respond to it.
Oh, shit.
Bush claimed that the memo must be talking about another George Bush working at CIA, because it couldn't be talking about him, because he had never been in the CIA.
Never been there.
Except for that time in 1974 when he was director of CIA.
Oh, shit.
Should we believe him? Let's make clear what we're talking about here. The George Bush of the memo, who received the report on misguided Cubans, was clearly a supervisor of the CIA's misguided Cuban operations. We've seen both the CIA and their misguided Cubans implicated in the Kennedy assassination. This is some important stuff, eh? The George Bush of this memo is directly implicated in the assassination. It makes a huge difference whether this was him or some other George Bush. But how can we know? Well, come on, it's basic stuff. Is there any corroboration? Is there any other evidence besides this memo to show whether Bush was in the CIA at this time, or that shows whether Bush was supervising anti-Castro Cubans? We'll start by looking at Bush's connections. A quick look at Alan Dulles may help us understand the importance of connections. Dulles worked closely with Nazi bankers during World War II. That somehow qualified him to become the director of the newly formed Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. He was the architect of the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. When he launched the invasion against Kennedy's orders, of course Kennedy fired him. So thinking people were shocked when he was virtually put in charge of the investigation, the Warren Commission, because he was the prime suspect as the leader of the assassins. But he had been fired. He was no longer the head of the CIA. How could he lead anything? Because the organizing principle in secret work is that you trust only the people you know personally and are connected to personally. The CIA is not so much an organization as a community, so that it hardly mattered that Kennedy fired Dulles. The men loyal to Dulles, who knew him and trusted in him, continued to trust and obey. In fact, Dulles stood at the center of the group of men who not only had the motive, but the ability to steal the body from the Dallas coroner, to steal it from the Secret Service, mutilate it, and return it, all without attracting public attention. Was George Bush a member of this community in 1963, as the Hoover memo says? Well, did he have close personal ties with these people? Let's examine that question. Certainly, one of Bush's main ties to this community is the connection between his father and Alan Dulles. In the 1930s and 1940s, Alan Dulles was a close business associate on a first-name basis with both Prescott Bush and Averell Harriman. Before that, during World War I, before there was a CIA, Prescott worked for Army Intelligence, a forerunner and parallel organization to the CIA. Through his closest associate, Averell Harriman, Prescott is also tied to Richard Bissell, the CIA Director of Operations for the Bay of Pigs, who was fired by Kennedy. Bissell, like Hunt, also worked for Averell Harriman for 10 years before joining the CIA. Prescott also partnered with William J. Casey, director of CIA under Reagan, in 1962. At the time, Kennedy was moving to dismantle the CIA. Prescott and Casey together founded the National Strategy Information Center to directly fight against Kennedy's efforts. But at the center of Bush's connections in the world of secret murder and filth is his membership in the Secret Society of Skull and Bones, a secret Yale fraternity famous for its celebration of racism, robbery, and death. This tomb is where they meet twice a week to engage in black rituals using skulls, candles, and ceremonial group masturbation. It's supposed to be kind of a gay group marriage thing. Brothers under the skin is how the Bonesmen describe their relationship. Their graduates are a powerful bunch of devils. Averell Harriman and Prescott Bush were Bonesmen. George Herbert Walker Bush was a Bonesman, and so was his uncle, George Herbert Walker. Robert Lovett, architect of the CIA, was a Bonesman, selected for membership by Prescott himself. F. Truby Davison was also selected for membership in Skull and Bones in 1918, the year Prescott did the picking.
Davison was in charge of hiring for the CIA in 1948, the year George Herbert Walker Bush left Yale in search of a job. Davison had a son, Endicott Peabody Davison. Endicott was skull and bones, class of 48, making him brother under the skin with George Herbert Walker Bush. He's also the Bush family lawyer. As both former president and director of CIA, old Beelzebub himself, George Herbert Walker Bush is the most distinguished of modern bonesmen. But the question is whether he was in the CIA in 1963, as Hoover says. In a world where personal connection is everything, no one could possibly have a closer relationship to the head of hiring for CIA than George Herbert Walker Bush. Bush's first job on leaving Skull and Bones was to work for Neil Mallon, brother under the skin to Prescott, class of 18. In a letter to White House aide C.D. Jackson, dated March 26, 1953, the now Senator Prescott Bush described Neil Mallon as a very old and dear friend. I might say that Neil Mallon is well known to Allen Dulles and has tried to be helpful to him in the CIA, especially in the procurement of individuals to serve in that important agency. So George went directly from Skull and Bones. He went directly from being a brother under the skin to the son of the director of hiring for CIA to working for a recruiter for the CIA.
You could not ask for more powerful evidence that Bush was in the CIA when Hoover said he was. But you can get it. This letter records a meeting between Prescott Bush, George's CIA promoting father, Neil Mallon, the CIA recruiter, and Allen Dulles, the head of CIA, to discuss, quote, our pilot project in the Caribbean, unquote. In 1959, the year that Allen Dulles began planning the CIA invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, Bush began his independent business career as the sole owner of Zapata Offshore Oil. Zapata Offshore's oil rigs just happened to be positioned right in the middle of CIA operations in the area 30 miles north of Cuba near Cay Sal, an island used by the CIA for supplying the various terrorist raids of Operation 40, Operation Mongoose, Alpha 66, and the rest of these murders against Cuba. The assassins of Operation 40 were supervised by E. Howard Hunt. Hunt was also a supervisor of the Bay of Pigs invasion. The secret code name for the Bay of Pigs invasion was Operation Zapata. Operation Zapata? Zapata Offshore? Now, you could fairly ask what kind of an idiot would give a secret operation a secret code name and name it after his own company that was operating in the area. What kind of idiot? George Bush, that's what kind of idiot. In World War II, Bush named his plane after his wife, the Barbara II. When this plane was shot down, what do you suppose he named his next plane? Did you guess it? The Barbara III. While the CIA was preparing for the Bay of Pigs invasion, the CIA ordered a large ship from the Navy to carry tanks and guns and men to the Bay of Pigs invasion. But no one was supposed to know this was a U.S. Navy ship. The world was supposed to believe that these were just private citizens of Cuba, so it was necessary to disguise the ship and to change the name. The name was changed to the Barbara. Now, this is not a big deal. It's a small deal. But it's there. Bush has a habit of naming things in his military career after things in his personal life. He named two planes after his wife, and one of the three CIA ships at the Bay of Pigs was renamed the Barbara. It's a small piece that just happens to fit perfectly with the bigger picture of Bush as a CIA officer working with anti-Castro Cuban terrorists. This same habit of naming things in his military career after things in his personal life also connects Bush's oil company, Zapata Offshore, to Operation Zapata and to the anti-Castro Cuban terrorists. But again, let's not overemphasize this name stuff. Finding the name of Bush's wife on a Bay of Pigs supply ship, or finding the code name of the Bay of Pigs invasion on his oil company, is a small but clear detail of this much bigger picture. The big picture shows us that at the same time that Hunt moved from working inside Harriman's office to go to the CIA where he supervised at the Bay of Pigs invasion, at the same time that Richard Bissell moved from working inside Harriman's office to go to work for the CIA, where he became the director of planning for the Bay of Pigs operation. At the very same time, the oldest son of Harriman's closest associate went to work in the exact same outdoor office where Hunt and Bissell were now operating. Hoover's memo names Bush as a CIA supervisor of the Bay of Pigs invaders, the anti-Castro Cubans. There can be no reasonable doubt about this connection. George Bush was working for the CIA, assisting in their operations at the Bay of Pigs, working for Bissell, working with Hunt, working with Sturgis, supervising the CIA's misguided anti-Castro Cubans. His supervision of Hunt and the others at the Bay of Pigs is a key piece of evidence linking him to the assassination, but it is not Bush's only connection to Hunt and the other suspects. After Bush got beaten up, losing two elections for Senate, Nixon brought his sorry butt into the White House, trailing E. Howard Hunt behind him. Haldeman says no one could figure out who brought Hunt into the White House, but it isn't that hard to figure out, because not only did Hunt and Bush come to work for Nixon at exactly the same time, but no one in the White House had any connections to CIA operations. No one had any connections. While Bush, on the other hand, was directly involved in the same CIA operations in the same area at the same time that Hunt was. And there's more to this story. Nixon's chief of staff says that everyone was astonished and flabbergasted in 1970, the day that Nixon announced that he was bringing John Connally into the White House as his Secretary of Commerce. No one understood the connection between these two, one the leader of the Republican Party and the other the leading Texas Democrat. Haldeman says, however, that Connally insisted that before they could hire him, they first had to get a White House job for Bush. Why? What is their relationship? What does Bush have to say about it in his autobiography? Not a word. Not one. If he and Connally ever spoke in their entire lives, Bush doesn't mention it. How can you possibly explain the connection between these people? Do these guys have anything in common? The answer is either no, they all came together in 1970 for no apparent reason, or the answer is this one. They all met on the same road to power. And there's more to the Nixon-Bush-Hunt connection than that they came together at the same time in the same place. Remember, when Hunt was sitting in jail demanding that Nixon pay him $1 million in hush money or he'd start talking? Hunt got paid. The money came from this man, Bill Leitke, George Bush's oldest, closest, and most important business partner. Leitke helped Bush found Zapata Offshore. And then, in 1959, when the CIA needed the company, Leitke handed the company to Bush, made Bush the sole owner, so Bush could carry out secret operations without any outside observers getting in the way. The fact that Bush's closest business partner paid Hunt the $1 million is just one more connection between Hunt and Bush. But wait, there's more. Remember this man? Leitke's money actually went to him. Ramon Rodriguez. He was a CIA-trained money launderer working in a Mexican bank, and he wrote the actual checks that Hunt received.
I made payments for the Watergate burglars, yes.
18 years later, in 1990, he was working for the main Colombian drug cartel when Vice President Bush sent this man to ask him for $10 million to help pay for the illegal terrorist war Bush was waging against the people of Nicaragua.
Well, the only government mention that he made was Vice President Bush. The request for the contribution made a lot more sense because Felix was reporting to George Bush. Here you have a CIA guy reporting to the old boss.
Now, how did Bush know this guy? How did he know he had $10 million, and how did he know that he would pay it? It's a good question. Whatever the reason, the connection is still there. Bush is connected to him by this incident, and through him, Bush again is connected to Hunt.
two more connections between Bush and Hunt. It's starting to get ridiculous. Hunt's mother is not so thoroughly connected to Hunt. And now let's look at Bush's role in the cover-up. In 1975, the Senate Select Committee on Assassinations began to investigate the CIA's role in the Kennedy assassination. The committee uncovered the CIA internal memo that Spotlight magazine wrote about, which says that Hunt was in Dallas on the day of the assassination. William Colby was director of the CIA at the time.
Oh yeah, Hunt was there all right. He and Bush were in charge of the shooters.
And he was cooperating with the committee.
But they weren't really in charge. They were just taking orders.
And supplied the committee with the Hunt memo.
From civilians, like Alan Dulles and the Rockefellers.
Colby was suddenly fired. And, out of the blue, supposedly with no CIA experience, George Bush Sr. was appointed to take over as head of CIA. Why? What qualified Bush for this job? One thing. Bush could be relied upon better than Colby to cover up the facts of JFK's murder because Bush knew that the trail led straight to him. He had to cover it up, and he did. He ended CIA cooperation with the committee and effectively shut down the investigation. The fact that Bush played this leading role in the cover-up connects him to every person threatened by this investigation. So, there's a ton of evidence that connects George Bush to John Kennedy's killers. But now we'll look at a couple of pieces of strange evidence that, while they don't connect Bush to the killers, do connect him to the assassination in ways that can only be described as... weird. This is George DeMorenschild. He was a wealthy, Russian-born Texas oil man who liked to party with minimum-wage clerks. He helped get Oswald a job at the Dallas School Book Depository. Of course, he was CIA. The night before he was to be questioned by the Senate Committee on Assassinations, his head was blown off with a shotgun. In his pocket at the time was an address book, and in his address book was the entry, Bush, George H.W., Poppy, his family nickname, 1412 West Ohio, also Zapata Petroleum, Midland. By itself, this proves nothing. Taken in context, however, it is one more amazingly direct link between Bush and the assassination. But that's not all. FBI documents record that, on the day of the assassination, at 1:45 p.m., Mr. George H.W. Bush telephonically furnished the following, that he recalled hearing in recent weeks, the day and source unknown, that one James Parrott had been talking of killing the president when he comes to Houston. Now what the hell do you make of that? Just crazy. When questioned about the FBI documents, Bush says he does not recall making the phone call. His failure to recall such dramatic events puts him into a unique club. Like Nixon and Hunt, he can't seem to remember the events of November 22, 1963. It seems that this guy was everywhere, connected to every single aspect of the assassination, planning, execution, and cover-up. No one, not Hunt, not Connolly, not Nixon, no one on the face of the earth could possibly have better credentials as a suspect than George Herbert Walker Bush. The scale in this case is tipped past a certain critical point. The probability that he was involved is genuinely beyond a reasonable doubt. The Hoover memo is not circumstantial evidence. It is direct eyewitness smoking gun evidence from the most influential figure in the history of American law enforcement. The rest of the evidence merely provides a context for this memo that makes it impossible to reasonably believe that the former president was not involved in the murder of John Kennedy. If we could present this evidence to an unbiased jury in Texas, they would certainly give him the death penalty. Ow! Ooh! Ooch! Oh! Ow! Ooh! Ow! Oh! Take it easy, fellas! Ow! Ooh! Ooch! Oh! Ow! Ooh! Ow! Oh! Take it easy, fellas! Ow! Ooh! Ow! When I was just a little... fool, my mama sent me off to a place called school. I liked the part about taking a nap, but seemed everything else was a load of crap. No fooling.
taught us George Washington chopped down a cherry tree so we could all have freedom, justice, and liberty. Did I mention Columbus discovered America? Well, I went off to college, and believe it or not, the harder I studied, the dumber I got. Taught us we was all geniuses, folks back home was asses, and elites like us ought to rule the masses. Some schooling. Had to drop out, though. Just couldn't seem to get my shoulders inside my asshole. Well, I got slapped in the face. No, it couldn't have been ruder. By a friend with a film by a guy named Zapruder showed Kennedy's brains getting blowed out the back. Seems the Warren Commission was hooked on crack. And the FBI, and all the TV and radio, and every newspaper on God's green earth. Well, the day JFK got blown away, old George Bush was in the CIA, and though E. Howard Hunt might have held the gun, George Bush Sr. was surely the one that said, do it. Told him again during Watergate, do it. Sold that slogan to Nike. 40 years later, I'm preaching away. Seems my head's still out in the light of day, but people are still crying, Kennedys are still dying, and the TV and the papers and the teachers still lying. Seems it's still pretty dark out in the middle of the day. Even if you don't have your head shoved up 3 miles up your asshole. There are many things we will never know about the assassination. The guilty parties have done all they can to make it this way. Investigations have been blocked. Much evidence has been destroyed. Witnesses have been murdered. We are left with bits and pieces. So what do? If we do what scientists do, we take the bits and pieces and try to guess what they mean, argue with each other, and try to figure it out. If we do what the prosecutors do, we develop a theory about what happened based on the evidence and challenge the accused to come up with an alternative explanation that isn't ridiculous. There are certain things about the Hoover memo that demand answers. Why did George Bush lie and say he was not the George Bush referred to in the memo? Why would the CIA ask the FBI to report to them about CIA operations? And why would George Bush leave Dallas the day of the assassination and travel all the way to Washington, D.C. to receive this stupid, lying report? We're going to take up these questions and others, and we should, because this is one of the most important pieces of evidence in the entire case and really deserves careful examination.
To understand what was in Hoover's mind when he wrote the memo, we need some historical background to understand the complex relationships between the FBI, the CIA, and Lee Harvey Oswald. While Oswald was in the Marines, he was stationed at a top-secret air base for U-2 spy planes, where he learned Russian. This is not the standard training for a Marine grunt. He was obviously being groomed for some sort of special intelligence work. He got a hardship discharge from the military to take care of his mother, who wasn't ill, and he immediately bought a plane ticket with money he didn't have and flew to Russia. As soon as he got to Russia, he renounced his U.S. citizenship and declared his intention to turn over all the military secrets he had learned while he was in the Marines. He later married and, after a few years, returned to the U.S., where all his friends were men with CIA connections and who all died shortly after the assassination and before they could testify about their relationship with him. So Oswald very likely at some point worked for the CIA. But, according to declassified secret documents of the Warren Commission, they were told by the Dallas District Attorney and the Attorney General of the state of Texas that Lee Harvey Oswald was working for the FBI at the time of the assassination, that his informant number was S-179, and that he was receiving $200 a month. In his wallet at the time of his arrest, he had the name, phone number, and license number of Dallas FBI agent James Hostie. Witnesses have testified about secret meetings and package exchanges between Oswald and other FBI agents outside this garage. In 1960, 3 years before the assassination, J. Edgar Hoover found time to write a memo regarding the lowly, insignificant lone nut, Lee Harvey Oswald. What the hell did Hoover find so interesting about this guy 3 years before the assassination? Hoover's memo complained that someone was using Oswald's identity while Oswald was in Russia to buy trucks for CIA-trained anti-Castro Cubans. Given this pile of evidence,
We have to admit that it was at least possible that Oswald was involved with the FBI.
What could Oswald possibly have been doing for the FBI? Well, what was the FBI doing? Hoover was helping JFK crack down on the CIA.
Less than 3 months after becoming president, Kennedy awoke one morning to discover that the CIA had launched a major invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs using their secretly trained army of misguided anti-Castro Cubans. Alan Dulles, the CIA chief, figured that if he launched an invasion with the CIA's private army, Kennedy would be forced to order an all-out invasion of Cuba to back them up. Kennedy refused to go along, and the entire CIA army was killed or captured.
Recently declassified documents show that Kennedy had never approved the CIA plan for a massive invasion at the Bay of Pigs. And while Kennedy publicly took the blame for the CIA disaster...
There's an old saying that victory has 100 fathers and defeat is an orphan, because I'm the responsible officer of the government.
He quietly fired the top 3 men at CIA, Alan Dulles, Richard Bissell, and General Charles Cabell. He still had an army of CIA-trained Cuban terrorists to contend with. He lied to them.
I can assure you that this flag will be returned to this brigade in a free Havana.
And he allowed them to keep training for raids against Cuba at several CIA-sponsored training camps under various names, Operation 40, Operation Mongoose, Alpha 66, and several others. But the Cuban Missile Crisis changed everything, and most of all, it changed John Kennedy.
In October of 1962, the world was brought to the brink of nuclear war when Kennedy was told that the Russians were building nuclear missiles in Cuba 90 miles off American shores. Kennedy announced that the U.S. would stop all Russian ships headed towards Cuba. The Russians announced that they would not be stopped in international waters by U.S. ships. Both sides prepared for war.
At the very moment that the world teetered on the brink of nuclear disaster, against Kennedy's specific orders, the CIA sent a U-2 spy plane flying into Russian airspace, which could easily have been mistaken for a bomber getting ready for a first strike. Right in the middle of this critical period, as both sides prepared for full-scale nuclear war against Kennedy's specific orders, the CIA instigated attacks upon Cuba by their anti-Castro Cuban paramilitaries. These insane attempts by the CIA to provoke a nuclear holocaust changed Kennedy fundamentally. He caught a glimpse into the souls of his adversaries, and he spoke of them as having a collective death wish for the world. The missile crisis ended when the Russians agreed to dismantle their missiles in Cuba. However, Khrushchev, the Russian leader, insisted that these CIA training bases be dismantled and that the Russians be allowed to verify this with inspections. Kennedy ordered these secret training bases closed, but many of the groups were openly defiant, refused to close the bases, and talked about murdering Kennedy. Kennedy ordered Hoover to locate these training bases and shut them down. Hoover was forced by Kennedy to go head-to-head with the CIA. Although no arrests were made, Hoover located the camps and shut them down. The question remains, how did Hoover locate these camps? Their location was secret even to the President of the United States. It's a very relevant question. We have seen a substantial amount of evidence that Oswald was an FBI agent. He was seen at the training camp in Lake Pontchartrain, Louisiana, by the secretary of the former FBI agent who ran the camps. This camp was raided and shut down days after Oswald visited there. Raiding and shutting down these camps was a highest priority operation of the FBI. These circumstances suggest that Oswald was, in fact, Hoover's most important agent in the field. So that on November 22nd, Hoover not only learned that the CIA had murdered the President of the United States, but that they had framed his top agent, Lee Harvey Oswald, as the lone assassin for the murder.
This news sent a very direct and very personal message to Hoover from the CIA. Mess with us and you die. This is the message that J. Edgar Hoover received from the CIA the day of the assassination, and this memo is a record Hoover made of his response to that message. The memo says that Hoover was asked to investigate the, quote, misguided anti-Castro Cubans, unquote, to see if they were planning any raids. But the CIA had been helping these misguided anti-Castro groups to conduct unauthorized raids against Cuba on a regular basis for years, until, on Kennedy's orders, Hoover's men began to raid the camps and shut them down. These camps were sponsored by the same agency that Kennedy had been fighting since his first day in office, the CIA. And now, with Kennedy dead at the hands of these misguided anti-Castro members of Operation 40, Hoover is asked to give a report on Kennedy's killers to their CIA sponsors. Now, you have to make some effort to appreciate this situation.
Oswald had infiltrated the CIA's Operation 40. Marita Loren says that Oswald was in the room with Hunt as he was passing out the money. Oswald was reporting to Hoover, so Hoover knew that the misguided anti-Castro Cubans were working with Hunt and helped to kill the president. On the other hand, when Hoover shut down the CIA secret terrorist training camps, the CIA figured out that Oswald was a rat, so they knew that Hoover knew. And yet, according to the memo, the CIA asks Hoover to tell them what he knows about the misguided anti-Castro Cubans. Why? You, sitting there, come on, think about it. Why does the CIA ask Hoover to tell them what he knows about their dirty laundry? When it's their dirty laundry, they got it dirty. Are they expecting to learn something about their own operations? I don't think so. Is it to find out how much Hoover knows? Because they already know that he knows everything about their dirty laundry. Then why do they ask him? Why? Remember that Bush called the FBI the day of the assassination? He told them that he was in the Dallas area, and then he got in a plane and flew to Washington? If he really wanted information on the anti-Castro Cubans, why didn't he go to Miami and talk to the FBI agents who were actually involved in investigating the Cubans? If he wanted to hear it from headquarters, why didn't he just call? And he already knew the answer to the question, so why did he go to all this trouble? There's something going on here. What? These are important questions. If you want to try to understand the world you live in, you can't just shrug them off. Science and criminal justice say that you have to come up with a better explanation than me, or else you have to accept my explanation. And my answer is pretty ugly. It seems to me that the CIA asking the FBI about their own dirty laundry is like the wife beater asking his wife to explain how a strange woman's panties got under the front seat of his car. You know I'm guilty, says the wife beater. Here's the evidence, says the wife beater. I know that you know, says the wife beater. Say the wrong thing. Go ahead, and you're dead. In asking this question, the CIA is totally punking Hoover. They're asking him, are you a little bitch who knows his place, who knows who's boss? Are you going to beg for mercy and tell us the lie we want to hear, or what? Or what? There's another good question. If Hoover grovels like he's supposed to, everything is fine. But what if he doesn't? What if he stands up and says, look, I've got the goods on you Nazi bastards, and me and my best friend Lyndon Johnson are going to take you down? You never know. Hoover didn't join the Nazis in 1942. He went after them. It's obvious that these guys don't know for sure what Hoover's going to say, or they wouldn't have to get on a plane and flying to Washington to ask. So now, here they are in Washington. But what are they supposed to do if Hoover gives the wrong answer? How hard a question is that? They just whacked the president the day before, so answer it. What are they going to do if they get the wrong answer? Are they just going to shoot him in the head right there in the FBI headquarters? Well, here's a hint.
The CIA had developed a pistol that shoots a dart made of ice. The dart contains a drug that gives the victim a heart attack. The ice dart goes into the body, melts, and the only evidence of a murder having been committed is a small pinprick left by the entry of the dart.
But also the toxin itself would not appear in the autopsy?
Yes, so that there was no way of perceiving that the target was him.
These thugs probably had such guns in their pocket. If Hoover gave the wrong answer, these two guys would kill him. Hoover told these thugs how the FBI investigation showed that the anti-Castro Cubans living in Miami loved Kennedy and were deeply saddened by his death. In fact, anti-Castro Cubans all over Miami were celebrating Kennedy's murder. But don't underestimate Hoover. Hoover was a master of intelligence. When he destroyed the Black Panthers for Richard Nixon, the head of security for the Panthers was an FBI agent. When Hoover destroyed the Communist Party for Eisenhower, the man in charge of the party's own membership list was an FBI agent. And he certainly got the goods on the Nazi collaborators in this country. Remember that Hoover busted Prescott Bush, the president's grandfather, as a Nazi collaborator and seized his bank. So what does Hoover do when this son of a Nazi bitch comes to threaten him? He writes this memo, that's what he does, creating a written record of George Bush's role in the assassination and hiding it in plain sight in a memo to the director of CIA. This memo deserves the close attention we've been giving it. You see, even with a CIA secret weapon in your hand, killing Hoover in his own office is an enormously risky project. Who would do such a thing? That's really pretty easy. The men who were so involved in the assassination that it was less dangerous for them to murder Hoover than to let Hoover conduct a real investigation of JFK's murder. This memo then strongly suggests that George Bush was such a man. It suggests that he was so covered from Kennedy's blood that murdering Hoover in his own office was an acceptable risk. In any case, this memo records George Bush's role as a key player in the conspiracy to murder Kennedy, serving at a high level to protect the misguided anti-Castro Cuban president killers from the FBI.
Are you enjoying this? Pretty ugly stuff. But wait, here's an even uglier and even more important question. George Bush is not like Nixon, a poor man's son who needs to kiss up to the big devils to get a place at the table. He was born with a place at the table, and with a silver spoon in his mouth. He was also born with a place waiting for him at Yale, and in Skull and Bones, and any place else he wanted. So why did he have to get directly involved the way he did? Listen, damn it, wake up. This is a critical question. Why would Prescott require his own son to get so directly involved in this stuff, to get so much blood on his hands, that his name turns up in a memo from the FBI chief entitled Assassination of John F. Kennedy? You answer that and you will have learned something. So, what's your answer? Well, you keep thinking about it, and then think about this. If you want to join the inner circle of a bunch of mafia-type killers, what do you have to do? How can these guys trust you to sit in on their private conversations where they discuss mass murder and single assassinations and know you won't rat them out? One way, they tell you who to kill, you do it, they watch. You don't have to pull the trigger, just participate enough that you're guilty of conspiracy to murder, and then they watch you do it, and now they have as much on you as you'll ever have on them, so they can trust you. In order to join this club, George Herbert Walker Bush had to be directly involved in the murder of John Kennedy, and from that moment on, his political future was made. He was a made man. He lost the race for Senate, they gave him a seat in Congress. He lost again for Senate, they gave him a job in the White House. He lost the primaries to Reagan, they made him vice president, and he ruled while Reagan napped for 8 years. Now, you ready? Who did little Georgie have to murder to get into the inner circle? Good question, eh? So, go figure it out. Ask him where he was the day John Kennedy Jr. died. Georgie was running for president. He was losing in New Hampshire. Even so, George disappeared in the morning. Kennedy's plane crashed for no reason that night, and Bush stayed missing for 3 days. No one on his staff could say where he was. Hey, maybe we should do some investigating.